I got into this for all the wrong reasons. I wanted to make money. And some people that I trusted said, this is a problem that you should be looking into. And over time, I developed a legitimate passion for this where like, yeah, I really do care about this. And so that is just so exciting to me to be able to look at a business from that perspective and then to be able to have that impact.
I'm Johnny Page. I'm Matt Verlet. And this is the South County Podcast.
Welcome to the SaaS Academy podcast, where we dive deep with SaaS founders and industry experts to uncover what it takes to scale your SaaS company to a perfect exit. And our guest today is a great friend and an absolute weapon in the world of SaaS and operations. Marcel Petipa is the co-founder and CEO of Parakeeto, software that's built to help service-based businesses measure and improve their profitability. And if his name sounds familiar to you, it's also because he's our head strategic coach at SaaS Academy. His wisdom has been an integral part of the framework that we use to coach our clients to success. And I'm fired up to have him on the podcast today to tap into his brilliance about SaaS, about agencies, about workout regimens and vitamins, and we'll see where else this conversation takes us. So Marcel, man, welcome to the show.
It is an honor to be a part of this experience, the Johnny and Matt show. Guys, I'm so glad you're doing this. You've got so much wisdom and so much knowledge, and it's a gift to the world to see you putting it out there like this. So I'm honored to be here.
I appreciate having you, man. So we'll set the stage for the people listening. We are coming off the tail end of a two-day intensive here in Austin, Texas. So for context, in SaaS Academy, we gather up all of our clients and different cities in the US or Canada for a very deep dive into specific subject matters within SaaS. And so how are you feeling coming off this thing? Because you've stepped into this role of MC where you're now the main guy on the stage, keeping everything moving. So like, what's going on in Marcel's world right now?
I'm feeling very grateful. Having been a client going through that experience and seeing where these events started and seeing what we've just been able to accomplish as a team, how smoothly everything went, the impact that we had on our clients, and to be able to be in a position where I can really have a significant impact on the experience that they have coming to this, knowing what it's done for me in my life. You know, the friends that I've made at these events, meeting the two of you and many other lifelong friends, changing the trajectory of our business, and being able to really create this thing that people can't explain when they leave. And so it becomes a shared, remarkable experience for our clients that, you know, makes them feel a part of something special. So feeling very, very good about what we've accomplished.
That's cool, man. It is really something that's tough to explain. You know, I was talking with a founder in the hallway after, and he had brought a team member, you know, one of his employees for the first time. And like, this dude's eyes were like saucers, man. And I asked the founder, you know, how is he feeling after the 2 days? And he was like, I'm so happy I finally decided to bring a team member because I'm just tired of trying to explain it. You know, it's like this thing where if you're the conduit for it, it has to be experienced, I think. And it's not about us. It's the community and just being in the room with a couple hundred people who get it. You said something from the stage that I put on Instagram because it made me laugh, but it was true. You said, you're finally in a room, all of you, where you can talk about your B2B SaaS company and everyone else's eyes won't glaze over. Like they all get it. And like, I don't know, man, it's a lonely journey. So it's cool to be able to set that room up.
Yeah. And I mean, we broke a record, which I think is something we should be really proud of. We had 250 B2B software as a service founders crammed into one room. And that was really special. Just watching people interact, like it really lights me up.
It was cool, man. So I think about today, right? You're the CEO of a SaaS company. You're the head coach at a coaching company that teaches people how to run SaaS companies. You know, you've got a great, you know, personal brand, a successful podcast, you know, you're out there all over the place, but it's been a journey from like the Marcel of the Apple Store days, right? I mean, so I look at what you do now, where I don't think there's a room on this earth you couldn't walk into for someone who's running a SaaS company or an agency and to teach them some way to improve their operations or some way to improve their profitability or some way to make that thing run a little bit more smoothly. Like what's been, I don't know, maybe just for some context, like how's that trajectory been? What's been the big stops on that train where you've picked up the most? You know, have you gotten from there to here?
I think it comes down to two things that I think I'm just very fortunate to have had. And the first is a raging superiority complex. Man,
I really thought you were going to say athletic greens. Like, holy shit.
Yeah. Use promo code Petipa. No, I think seriously, the first one is just this like, this deep-seated self-confidence that I think, frankly, I got from my parents. I look around and there are people whose families don't support them or believe in them or try to like protect them usually by getting them to down regulate their goals and dreams, and have no idea what that's like, because my parents just always got behind me no matter what I wanted to do. They supported me. They, you know, allowed me to believe in myself. And so I've always had this very high degree of self-confidence. And in my early days, mixed with a healthy dose of naivety, I sold myself into situations that I was not at all qualified to be in. But that created the container for me to have to figure out how to get through it. And I think that that's so much of being, especially a first-time entrepreneur, is you just have to make these, you have to overcommit and trust yourself to know that you will find a way to get to the answers. And that, paired with being surrounded by incredible mentors from very early on in my career, Dan being one of those very instrumental ones that not only was there supporting me, but also opening doors, making introductions, and helping me get surrounded. Those two things coming together, I think, just allowed me to learn the right lessons at the right time and do it at a very fast pace to accomplish, you know, a lot in a very short period of time. So I feel very lucky to have had those opportunities.
Yeah, man, you said something that struck me about like the impact of being naive, right? And I look back, and it's funny, my wife actually jokes about this, you know, where like if she knew the odds of having a successful business, she might have been like, I don't know if this is such a good idea. Do you think you still do what you've done if you know what you knew what you were getting into in the early days? Or do you think being naive, a little bit of uninformed optimism, is like a critical ingredient to getting it done in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, hindsight's 20/20. Looking back, it was way harder than I thought it was going to be. It took way longer than I thought it was going to take. You know, I thought I was going to be a billionaire by now. To be fair, like I kind of got started for all the wrong reasons. I had a chip on my shoulder. I had something to prove. A lot of that was driven by insecurity. But even if I hadn't gotten the outcomes, the relationships I built, the skills that I developed, the opportunities that came out of just going out and playing this game of entrepreneurship, I wouldn't trade for anything. And so I don't think I would have done it differently. And looking back, you know, I can appreciate all the reasons that I think it was important that it didn't go the way that I planned, and that it took longer than I thought it was going to, because those were the moments where I had to learn important lessons. And a lot of those lessons were not tactical. They were emotional. They were strategic. They were about, you know, self-worth and self-confidence and belief and, you know, those things that often are at the root of why somebody isn't getting to that next level.
Dude, 100%. Where I want to start is, you know, especially within the context of bootstrapped SaaS founders, the path from running a services company of some type, whether it's a creative agency or some other derivative of a service-based company, the path from doing that and then using that to springboard into a SaaS platform, I think it's a path that's relatively well lit, right? It's been done a number of times, but I'm curious from your standpoint, like, what are the things that aren't different? Because I think we'd spend a lot of time talking about here's what's different and gross margin this and scalability that. And I think there's a lot out there. And so, yeah. But I think there's a lot of things that we treat differently that might not actually be different. So, you know, I love to focus on the things that don't change.
Yeah.
What do you take from point A to point B if you're on that journey?
So, I mean, this is where I have my 4X MVP process, where if you think about the difference between a software company and a service company, to me, it's just one layer. It's a delivery mechanism, which is product. And I think in many ways, the lines between those two things are getting blurrier all the time, especially in modern day SaaS. And actually, if you go back to enterprise SaaS, the lines were very blurry back then as well, where it was very hard to parse apart software and services because those were often sold in tandem because of the complexity of the problems that were getting solved and the lack of technical resources that organizations had in order to deploy these things. And so if I think about the progression, the first thing that is true about every business, in my opinion, is that the foundation of that business is a problem. If I think about this like, you know, an oil well, like the oil is the problem. And so you could have the best oil well, you could drill a billion different places, and if you never hit oil, who gives a shit? It doesn't matter. And I think products and businesses and services are all the same in that their value is based on the leverage that they have in solving a problem and creating value through solving that problem. And so that is a common thread. And then the second piece that I think is ubiquitous is having a point of view. And this is something that I don't think enough businesses appreciate, is that many of them have a unique point of view on this problem, why it exists, why other things aren't solving it, what a better way to do things are. and having clarity on what your point of view is and why it's unique or why it's compelling and being able to articulate that to the world is a really important component. I think that that's ubiquitous. And then the next piece that I made the mistake of skipping over, it was a very expensive lesson and I had to learn it many times over, and I see it happen all the time in service-based businesses trying to build product or in product businesses that are jumping straight to product, is you have to have this minimum viable process where software just makes a process more repeatable, more scalable, more reliable. It's just a conduit, a delivery mechanism for a process. But if you don't figure out what steps and actions need to take place in order to solve that problem, then why are you writing code? Why are you using this very expensive, very slow to change, very cumbersome mechanism if you aren't fully confident that that process is actually going to deliver the desired outcome to customers? And that was the biggest mistake that I made as a product entrepreneur, was not really appreciating the importance of dialing in that process before jumping to the thing that we're all excited about, which is writing code. But those first three layers, I think, are exactly the same and are the starting point. And if there is a progression to software or product, great. But if not, if you nail those first three, you're going to have a business, and that business is going to create value and be a monetizable asset.
Okay. So help describe, because I think you're glossing over what happened. What happens when those aren't in place?
Yeah.
And I think the most common, like, we get to see this quite frequently in SaaS accounting. What does it look like when someone skipped over one of those pieces? What are the symptoms?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if you skip over problem, you're a hammer running around looking for a nail. And I think, especially as a young entrepreneur, I did this all the time where I would come up with a product idea and then I would try to back into finding a problem to solve with it. And it just never worked. I just never found customers. Like, people weren't buying. It wasn't resonating. You know, of course, when you're young, a lot of people will tell you, that sounds cool. And like, they'll give you support. But the second you start asking for money, it doesn't really go anywhere. The second piece is the point of view. You don't have a compelling point of view, then you might be able to find a problem that people are experiencing, but you can't convince them to switch off of the status quo or to choose you over an alternative because you can't articulate in a compelling way why they should do that. Why placing a bet on your way of doing things is going to get them a better outcome or is going to be worth the switching cost. And so that's really about having a story that repeatedly gets people leaning in and interested and feeling like, yeah, your take on this is compelling and I can trust that you have an insight here. And then process, I mean, this is just not having product market fit. So you might be able to sell it and fuck, we were stuck here for so long. You know, I shared the story from stage. We were stuck here for almost 3 years where the curse was, we understood the problem very well, and it was a very real problem in the market. That insight is the reason we are alive today at Parakeeto, is because that problem existed, and every quarter we deepened our understanding of that problem. We had a very compelling point of view. And when we went out into the market and we published content and I went on podcasts and I did speaking, people gravitated towards us. They wanted to know what we were doing, even though it was vague on the website. We weren't clear about what we were doing. People just were so compelled by our point of view that they would book calls and they would talk to me. And the problem was, then I would sell them on a product and then they would get onboarded and they wouldn't get activated. They weren't using it. It wasn't really quite the right fit. And we never were able to create recurring outcomes for clients to actually solve the problem, to get them to stick around, continue to pay us. And that's because we didn't fully understand the process. And the issue with trying to solve that process problem with product was the feedback cycles were way too long, right? So it's like, okay, we built something, we put it in front of a customer, we spend a couple of weeks interviewing them, watching them use it, collecting the feedback, figure out that it's not working. We make a list of things that we want to try to make it better. It takes 2 to 6 weeks to make those changes in the product. We go through another several weeks. It's like, we're talking months. Right? So if we got one iteration, one shot on net every month, we only have 12 opportunities a year to close that gap. It was way too slow.
Yeah. That is a beautiful framework for positioning. When positioning is off, if you said, first, be able to articulate the problem. Okay. Make sure that you can do that. We found that X experiences Y. So we figured, and boom, your point of view.
Yeah.
So, because of the point of view, if instead of doing it the way that causes the problem, you had this process and then you introduce your product, you have so much more compelling, even rolled the client is leaning in, or the prospect's leaning in, versus we say, hey, we created a product. And most founders go the other way around.
Yeah.
And man, it's just, I hope you are okay with me evangelizing that for, for, because that is a beautiful way to articulate the need for not only what should your company look like, but how do you communicate about it in any of your marketing, you know, sales process, et cetera.
And like, if you sequence building the company that way, you also solve the problems in the order of sequence that they need to be solved in, which is, you know, if you're out talking about a problem and it's compelling, you're going to have surface area with the market. If your point of view is compelling, you're going to start attracting people. That surface area with the market is what allows you to start trying to iterate on a process. And then once you iterate on the process, now you have all the building blocks to sell a product, and you have all the copy, you have all the examples, you have the case studies, the testimonials. And this is how we teach marketing in SaaS Academy. It's all aligned, right? The content is about the problem. The lead magnet is about the point of view. The sales process is about the process and the product. So it all really is aligned in that sense.
Yeah. I want to double click on the point of view for a minute, because I think especially in what I would consider contemporary company building, right? It's 2024 when we're shooting this. And one of the things that in SaaS Academy, especially, we're leaning into, and that I know the three of us are all leaning into personally, is the importance of, as a founder or a, you know, C-level executive or whatever your role is, as a leader, you are essentially a media company in some way, shape, or form. And I don't think this was true, definitely not 10 years ago, maybe not even as ubiquitous 5 years ago. But now I don't know that there's a way to get your point of view, to your point, out into the market without producing content regularly and getting, like you said, that surface area. So, you know, I think that if I look in the mirror and try to figure out, as the CEO of my first company a few years ago, what were my limiting beliefs around producing content and getting myself out there, it always felt like it was extraneous to company building. It felt like it was this accessory, it was a distraction, it was this thing that I could do when I had time, which I never did have time or do it, right? And there's always something more important to do. And so if you were coaching past Matt today on that in today's operating environment, right? Like, just talk a little bit, because you're everywhere. Like, we talk every week probably in real life, but then every day you're in my Instagram feed going on podcasts. It's like your presence is dialed, you know, and I know that your point of view is everywhere in the market that you serve with Perikito. So what would you tell a founder today, man? Like, how do they prioritize this in their heads?
Yeah. I mean, it starts with just being able to articulate it. And then the thing that has worked best for me has been trying to borrow platforms from other people that allow me to go out and share that point of view. And the feedback loop that is very rewarding is when you realize just how compelling this is and people give you that feedback. And it's crazy to me that, like, you know, we talk a lot about the bridge between finance and operations in a professional services firm. And when I have like a CFO that's been working in professional services for 20 years, reach out to me and say, I finally understand these things that I haven't really been able to wrap my mind around in 20 years. And what's crazy about this is, like, I've only been thinking about it for 4 or 5. It's like, how did we figure this out? But that is such a rewarding moment when I have a founder that says, like, I have been struggling to understand my own business for years, and now it's clear to me how to think about it because of what you've communicated. That is going to get the juices flowing in terms of, like, feeling compelled to do it. And the hack that I used was I started a podcast and I would just invite people onto the show that I wanted to be on their platform. And so that was my way of kind of extending an olive branch, build the relationship, bring them on the show. You do the little chit chat before and after. And next thing you know, you're invited on their podcast. And then what I discovered by accident is the people that ran all the podcasts in our industry also ran the coaching programs and did the events and ran the other companies that we could partner with. And so it was just by going out, sharing this message, having that surface area with the market, getting the feedback, having the conversations, and borrowing other people's platforms that eventually, you know, we built this really strong authority in the market. And now people are pointing to us as being on the bleeding edge of this problem space.
Yeah, because I remember when we were talking about your experience taking Perikito to market, and please fact check this, but I think you had said that, like, earned media, specifically going on podcasts, was kind of your first, like, real scalable channel. But what you're saying is that upstream of that, you created your podcast first, and that gave you the in to kind of start working out those relationships that allowed you to scale earned media?
Those two things were happening in tandem.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. That's cool. What would your, you know, your quick hit list be if I'm a founder and I'm like, hey, I'll go on these podcasts, like, cool. But how does this turn into business? Like, how do you get from A to B?
So you want to think about it in terms of the funnel, right? So we talk about these three important stages of the buyer's journey, as it were. And the way I frame this is like, if you put an ad in front of 100 people, how many of them you think woke up this morning and said, I need to buy software to do this thing in my business? It's not that many, right? Maybe 10% if you're lucky. The vast majority of your average customer, even if they're your perfect target, they're either at the awareness phase, which is they don't even know they have a problem that needs to be solved. They might be experiencing it, but they don't know how to recognize the symptoms. They're not even aware that this is something that could be solved. Or they know that they have a problem, but they're just not in a place where they know how to even evaluate a solution. They don't know how to think about how to solve that problem. And so when we think about creating content at the awareness level, that's really about educating people about these problems, helping them understand how to recognize them, understand the impact of those things, that they could solve them, that there are ways to solve them. And that's what getting on a podcast and sharing that perspective is really about, is you're getting in front of an audience. And you know, let's say there's 5,000 agencies that listen to this podcast. Well, now 5,000 agencies have the opportunity to hear my perspective on, hey, if you're feeling these symptoms or you've ever experienced these kinds of things in your business, it probably means you have a profitability problem. And then the way that that leads to business is, this is the funny thing, you never have to sell on a podcast because the host will always ask you to sell if you don't do it first. And so at the end of every show or at some point throughout the show, you're going to mention something. You're going to say, oh, by the way, you know, we've got a blog post on this, or we have a free resource that you can download. Or at the end, at the very least, they'll say, tell our audience where they can, you know, learn more about you. And at that point, the key is you have to have a lead magnet. You have to have a middle of funnel call to action. What you don't want to say is, hey, you know, check us out at our website, book a demo if you want to work with us. What you want to say instead is, and this has been the key for us, is we create a lead magnet called the Agency Profitability Toolkit. And so at the end of every podcast, it's like, hey, if you listen to this, it resonated with you and you want to go deeper into this, I put together training videos, cheat sheets, checklists, everything that you need to start implementing what we've talked about without paying us a dime. And you can grab it for free by going to this link. It goes into the show notes. And like one podcast, you'll get a few leads right away when it's published, and then you'll get a slow trickle for years after that. But when you do 100 of those in 18 months, those things stack up. It's like these short or long tail niche keywords in SEO, where like one of them gets you 50, you know, people to your website a month, but 100 of them, all of a sudden it's really significant. So that's kind of how it builds, and it lays the foundation now for building your own content and your own audience as well.
It's cool. And I love how that, like, I'm drawing a chart in my head about what you're walking through, but right when you're thinking about the awareness phase, like it correlates to the problem, like that first step of the 4X MVP, right? And then your lead magnet correlates to the point of view, right? So if the way that I explain this problem resonates with you, I'll further explain my point of view and arm you to understand how I think about it with this lead magnet, right? And then from there, you get to continue the conversation. So it feels really tightly coupled.
100%. And here's the crazy thing about this is it takes a little bit of while to build your momentum. But you will get these kind of quick hits every time that you get on a podcast. There'll always be a handful of people that are listening, that are in the, like, they're in the decision phase. They go, this is exactly what I've been looking for. They reach out, they book a demo right away. Then over the next 30 to 60 days, you'll have people at the consideration level that kind of make their way to that point. Then you'll have some people that over the course of years now, they subscribe to your podcast, they start listening to your stuff, they hear you on other shows, and eventually they make their way down. And what's crazy is I get on sales calls with people and they're like thanking me for making the time. They feel like it's like a privilege for them to be on a call with me. They're using my language. They're describing the work that they've done in the toolkit to try and get some of this stuff in place. And this to me is like the real secret, is if you can get to a place where your lead magnet teaches your customer how to evaluate a problem in a way that positions you as the only possible option, then it's game over.
Game over, man.
And that is how I know that it's working, is I get on a sales call and there's no sale that needs to happen. They're just like, I believe in your framework. I've done the work. I'm stuck. I don't know where to go next. And you're the only person that I know of that can help me with this. And it's like, all right, well, here's the next step.
Created the game and you just so happen to know how to play it pretty well.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So I'm elbows deep in the Parakeeto buyer's journey right now, but we're going to keep on going, right? So you've talked to, gosh, at this point, probably thousands of agency owners or service business owners. about their profitability problems. And I'm going to tie this back into SaaS in a minute, but I just want to know, what makes this a big enough problem for you to focus your whole professional career on it? Like, I understand in the context of a single agency, of course, but like, I'm assuming that, you know, not being able to generate a healthy enough profit regularly is a pretty prolific problem in service-based businesses. There are a lot of things that can erode it. Like, what do you see in a service-based business that makes you want to go attack this problem?
I think originally it was less, again, I got into this for all the wrong reasons. I wanted to make money. And some people that I trusted said, this is a problem that you should be looking into. Now, I had experienced that. I had run a service business before. So I was like, yeah, you know, this resonates. I know that it was a problem for me. I started talking to other agencies. It was a problem for them. And over time, I developed a legitimate passion for this where like, yeah, I really do care about this. I love thinking about it. And I think what I started to understand was I just love business models and understanding business models and understanding them at this very nuanced level, where there's something incredibly powerful about being able to look at a set of numbers and immediately know what the problem is, right? And you guys know this, we have the same kind of framework for a software company. It's different, but it has the same power. And it's things like we had this agency we worked with, an entrepreneur that I respect a tremendous amount. You know, he's been in the game for 20 years, building his agency, went through a business model change and went from making a ton of money to losing over $1 million a year for 3 straight years. And his thesis was, you know, we're going to make this business model change. We're going to build out the team and we'll scale into it. And he called me one day and he said, Marcel, I'm getting worried that we're not going to grow out of this because our top line keeps going up, but we're losing $1 million a year. And once we had all their data collected and cleaned and organized, it took us 15 minutes to say, change this, this, and this. You don't have to change your pricing. You don't have to change how many hours your team works. You don't have to cut your overhead costs. You can go from losing $1 million to making 1.2 in the next 12 months. And it was so obvious to me, but it's because we had developed this mastery over the business model. And so that is just so exciting to me to be able to look at a business from that perspective and then to be able to have that impact on an industry that makes up, I mean, services. What percentage of businesses are a service-based business or have a component of services? It's a lot, right? And if small business is the backbone of our economy, agencies are the backbone of small business. And so the ripple effect to me is really, really huge. And the other thing that gets me really excited is most of our clients experience dramatic increases in profitability and top-line revenue, and their teams work less overtime, less weekends, because we're doing it in the right way. We're doing it by actually empowering them to make decisions and look around corners, which counteracts, I think, what has been a cultural problem in services, which tends to be this exploitative business model where we're letting our team subsidize the fact that we're mismanaging the business because they're going to throw their evenings and weekends at it. And so all of those things, you know, really fill me up. It's not really about making, you know, the owner more money, although I do love seeing an entrepreneur get rewarded for the risk that they took, but it's when all of the stakeholders in the business are better off because they now have this mastery and this control over their business model. I mean, that's pretty fun.
Yeah. And the trickle-down effect on customers is important too, man. Because like I know, like Johnny, you've worked with a ton of agencies and I've worked with a few, we've worked with a few together. And you can always tell the difference between the agency that's well-resourced, well-run, and you know that you may not have 100% of your person's focus, but you have enough of the focus that you need to drive, you know, outsized results with the expertise that they have. And you really know when you have, you know, 1/17th of their focus because the agency's under-resourced or not, you know, not doing the things that that they need to do. I mean, we've been on both sides of that.
I feel like you're the perfect person to ask this question because I got this soapbox called there's only 1% of agencies worth working with. And I have this theory, and maybe you can help illuminate why this happens.
Sure.
But I think that most agencies, their entire profitability and business model lies on being able to stay just above the standard that would get them fired for a client. So they're not waking every day saying, how do I solve this problem the best and the most and create the most efficiency and, you know, upside for my client. I'm trying to figure out a way to, how do I invest the least amount of resources to still not get fired? And I'm just going to oscillate with that. So, you know, you talk to consumers of agencies and they develop this aggressive, if they're going to get results out of agencies, they develop this aggressive mindset around like an agency is someone you have to cajole frequently to get them to perform well.
Yeah.
What do you see in the top performing agencies that pass on the most amount of value for their clients? And should I update my point of view on agencies or should I keep this soapbox?
So I think the reason for that is you have to look at the incentive structure of a service-based business where their cost is the amount of time that they spend on you. And whether they want to acknowledge that or not, they might be selling based on value, they might be selling flat fees, but the underlying business model of a service-based business by definition is it's labor arbitrage. You purchase 2,080 hours of somebody's life at a fixed price. You try to go resell as many of those hours at a profit as possible. And if you do that properly, all three of the stakeholders in that relationship win. The client gets what they want. That person gets a stable income and a rewarding job. And you as a business owner make a profit. That's a nice commerce situation that's going on there if you do it right. But to your point, the incentive, if they want to drive their cost down, is to spend as little time as possible delivering that outcome to you. Now, we get back to why profitability is important. Now, if you have a good process that works, that delivers that outcome in a repeatable way, and you found a way to make it efficient, that's not inherently a bad thing. But when an agency is in a position that they're not that profitable, then they're usually not willing to be the authority in that relationship and stand their ground and corral the client away from the things that they're going to want to do, often because they bring their baggage to the relationship as well, and they try to take control of the engagement. And when you're afraid of losing the client, you're often going to let those things slip. Then you get thrown off of your process, and now all of a sudden things start to become a bit of a mess.
Spiral, yeah.
Right? Wow. Because my job as a consultant, and just like my job as a coach in SaaS Academy, is often protecting the client from themselves. The reason the client is in the position that they're in is because the thing that they were doing wasn't working. And generally, if they're coming to me, it's because they recognize that I have expertise, I have a system, I have an insight into how to solve this problem. So to the extent that they can let us do our thing, we are in a better position to deliver that outcome to them in a way that also gets us the outcome that we need, which is a profit. And it's when we are afraid of losing the client, we're operating from a place of scarcity, and we are not willing to put our foot down and say, no, client, I understand that you feel that it should be done this way, but you hired me because I'm an expert. I'm going to need you to stick to our process. Then that's when we get into trouble because we get pulled out of our process. The scope starts to get away from us. We're not doing things exactly the way they need to be. We get indigestion. And then we run into this weird tension where it's like, okay, we're going over budget. It's not profitable for us. The client's not happy. Now everybody's screwed. And so to me, that's kind of the key is running your business well enough that you can actually be a better steward for your client's best interests by showing up in that relationship purely from a place of serving them and not being afraid of losing them because you stood up for what was actually in their best interest as an advisor.
That's a vicious circle, right? Because it's like, I can't afford to lose this client, so I'll over deliver, which eliminates the profit I was going to earn from this client. And now my financial situation is worse and I really can't afford, you know what I mean? It's just you keep doing all the wrong things.
Yeah.
I frequently get hit up like, hey, we have this service. We'd love for you to try it. And I started just at first ask, I'm just like, if it's on performance, down to play. If you're so confident and you want to build a LinkedIn group that's going to deliver X number of leads, or you want to whatever service, like you just get hit with hundreds of them. And I'm like, if it's on performance, like I'm down. Is it, do you see, are there agencies that have this mixed? You mentioned incentives and I immediately go to like, what if when we both win, we both win? And what if we don't create the outcome, you know, we share in the downside as well. Do you see that happening? Or is it more so? I mean, I think your point on owning the process that you were hired for the expertise is a phenomenal one to think through and to recognize our role as a client. And when are we disrupting their process? Like, are we hiring them because they're the cheapest? Or are we hiring them because they have an expertise that we believe they can deliver on and we're going to let them run their process? But do you see anyone operating on a more performance-driven model? Are there pockets of it?
Yeah, there are lots of agencies operating on performance, and I put them in two distinct camps. The ones that should be doing it because they have actually developed enough expertise that there is very little risk around their process. They understand the cost of that process and they can price the risk in, and they understand how to de-risk the outcome for a client. And so an example of this would be like a very experienced conversion rate optimization firm, where before they reach out to you, they can go on your website, they can run some diagnostics, or like an SEO firm. And right away they can go, yeah, if we do these four things, we know that we're going to get the outcome for the client because we've done it a million times. Then they can come to you and say, we're willing to work on performance, because they're actually pricing all of that risk in. There are very few firms that have enough experience, enough sophistication, enough operational prowess to be able to repeatedly do that. And they tend to be very mature. And the reason that they would do that is the opposite of the reason that most agencies are pricing on performance, which is they have no track record, they don't know what they're doing, and this is their way of trying to close deals by taking all the risk off the table for the client. And there might be some merit to doing that as an agency so that you can earn the right to build that skill set. But in my opinion, I think you need to be forthcoming that that's why you're doing it. And I don't think a lot of folks that are doing that right now are being forthcoming. And so that ends up being, I think, a little bit of a slippery slope, and you see them have a lot of churn and burn a lot of clients out. And I don't love how a lot of agencies are operating in this kind of value-based or outcome-based pricing model that are not coming at it because they understand intentionally that this is a way of us for us to capture more of the value that we create for our clients that we're very confident we can deliver on.
So you don't love it for the agency owner or for the client?
I don't love it for either one when it's being done from a place of, we're just doing this to try and close the deal, even though we don't actually know if we can deliver this outcome.
Well, because I think it's like even more risky. I think at least having the conversation on performance driven or not, it gets the conversation around risk central to the conversation.
Yep.
Where if it's not, if it's baked into the retainer, like I find that I'm the person bringing this up. I'm like, okay, I have to go all on trust that you're going to deliver this outcome. And if you don't deliver it, you just go find another one of me. But I'm left with the mess that you made or all the downside. You didn't create like this. So it doesn't have to be purely performance driven, but I do, like it's the way that the best agencies I've worked with, we figured out a way to. Number one, there's just some that are exceptional. It's not everyone that says, how do I do the least amount to get paid and not get fired? There are some that truly care about the problem they're solving. So I've ruled them out completely, but I just put a big warning label. Like when they think it's the easy button, when a founder thinks it's the easy button to solving that problem by hiring an agency to do it, it's dead on arrival.
Well, and you raised something that's, I think, really important. And this is part of what I talked about yesterday in my pricing model quadrant is you have to be clear about what's being bought and what's being sold. Because when you're talking about a service business, there are basically two things that are typically bought and sold. On one side, you're buying and selling time. That is a legitimate service-based model where it's like, I need a skill set and I need a certain amount of it. And as a client, I'm going to take more of the responsibility for dictating what that is being spent on. And those are typically going to be more tactical execution focused thing. And so that's a labor arbitrage model. I'm really good at going and finding, onboarding, training, and then finding placement for that kind of skill set and talent. And then the other side of that is outcomes. And typically your progression as an agency should be that you start by selling a skill set. That gets you surface area with the market. We come back to the Forex MVP. You understand the problems. You develop a point of view. You figure out what the process is to deliver that repeatable outcome. Then you can start to shift to selling outcomes and using that frame to hopefully create better margins for yourself, more control over the engagement, be able to capture more of that value. But I think where people get tripped up is where the client wants to buy an outcome, they really should be selling time. But that conversation never explicitly happens. Because I think the flip side of that is if it's like, hey, I need customer support VAs. And somebody's like, cool, you know, we can sell you those for $50 an hour. They're trained. Here's our process for how to train them. Like, here's how we interface with each other. And you're like, cool, I've got our playbooks. Like, we have a process to get them ramped up. Then you're not going to be like, oh, you know, I'll only pay you if they have a certain CSAT level NPS. It's like, that's a different conversation than saying, hey, we have this marketing problem that we don't know how to solve and we need you to be the expert.
Totally.
But that conversation is important.
How can you label the two? It's like one, it is a helpful distinction to make between when am I, you've got like, it's to one thing to say, hey, I'm going to outsource content marketing, the production of our website and all of the things that go into it. So then the agency needs a lot more autonomy and control over the creative process versus, hey, I need a web designer.
Yeah, I think it's a skill versus a process, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's like, you know, you can buy a house or hire someone to build you a house, or you can hire someone to sell you wood and sell you screws and sell you drywall, or I need someone to come hang the drywall and mud the drywall, but I'm going to choose where the drywall goes. And I just know that I'm really bad at mudding drywall.
Mm-hmm. So you've worked at this intersection between SaaS and agencies for a while. What's the biggest opportunity for SaaS companies from 10K to 250K in MRR to leverage an agency? Is there certain departments, certain problems that solve where you're like, I'm familiar with several horror stories because I poorly managed agencies myself for a very long time. I've gotten better at it, but I'm curious if you've seen the success stories.
So to me, this comes back to kind of the three swim lanes within the marketing function that I think are really important to understand and know like what you're solving for. And at the top, you have the strategy. And the strategy is going to be the most difficult and expensive to have somebody else take care of. And usually at an early stage company, somebody on the founding team needs to take responsibility for learning how to own that strategy and manage it. And thankfully, you know, like if you're a part of something like SaaS Academy, we could teach you how to do that pretty damn quick and give you a very, very reliable and simple framework to establish the strategy and do it with very little time and effort. Then underneath that, you have what I call management, which is, okay, we know what the strategy is. Now somebody needs to put the plan together. Who's doing what? When are they doing it? When's it due by? Put it in the project management system, like quarterback the execution of this. And hopefully they've got enough experience in marketing that they know what things look like. They know how to evaluate, you know, if something is good or bad or how these things are going to work together. And then you have execution, which is just actually doing the thing. Somebody needs to write the copy for this email. Somebody needs to design the graphic for this landing page. Somebody needs to send this email campaign or set up the ads. And so typically I think about buying that time back from the bottom up because there is so much less risk at the execution level than there is even at the management level, than there is at the strategy level. And the cost of labor is typically going to go up the further up that ladder you go. And the number of agencies that are going to be successful at getting you an outcome is going to decrease exponentially as you move up that ladder. So that's generally speaking how I would think about that progression.
I love that layout because it's counterintuitive to how a lot of, especially early stage founders think. We're like, I just want to outsource responsibility for this whole function I don't know how to do. Let me go find an agency to market my thing or to go sell my thing, right? And it's definitely a bottoms up play is the right way. So here's what I can say is we're going to do a part two because there's a whole stack of things that I want to get into that I know we're not going to be able to do justice with the time we have together today. But you know what I've taken from this so far is there are really three buckets of agency related, you know, insights that I wanted to riff with you. The first is how does it relate to early days and, you know, iterating about the product? And I think the 4X MVP model really helped drive that home. Second is the conversation that you just took us through about how should a SaaS company kind of consume an agency or work with them? And when we do a part two, what I want to hit is like exploring the way that the two circles in the Venn diagram between a SaaS company and an agency overlap, right? Because a lot of people think I need to be an agency or be a services company and then abruptly switch gears and hooray, now I'm a SaaS company. And I just don't believe, and I know we share this belief, that that line is, it's not a line, it's a spectrum, it's a continuum, right? It's a very gray area. And I think that topic probably deserves its own space to go super deep on. So I'm going to sign you up for a part two and you're not allowed to say no. That's where I'm at.
All right. I'm in. Yeah, that's a great one. And I think, you hear the stories like Basecamp, and it's a great story, but I think it sets absolutely the wrong expectation for what that should look like as you transition. And so would love to talk more about that.
Totally, man. Well, I'll ask you the question you said I would ask you, which is where can people go to find out more about Marcel?
Well, if you'd like to learn more about us and Parakeeto, you can head to parakeeto.com. If you want to learn more about profitability and professional services, you can go to parakeeto.com/toolkit and get a checklist, training videos, and cheat sheets to teach you how to implement all the things that we talked about.
But just in case you people who are watching this weren't sure how to do it, that's how you do it.
Yeah, there it is.
And Marcel coaches at least once a month in SaaS Academy. So if you're a SaaS founder and you want to have regular interactions with Marcel, helping diagnose that top level strategy, work through all this, you should come hang out in SaaS Academy. Yeah. He also runs a pretty great event too. Yeah.
So. He does okay.
Use promo code Marcel Pedophile.
There we go.
Brother, thanks for coming on, man. It was a blast. I appreciate you, dude.
Thanks for having me, guys.